everybody, and welcome to Comedy Death Star, the podcast that digs into the dark side of comedy. That's what we do here. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. My guest this week is Gary Austin, founder and original director of The Groundlings, and so much more. Right now, an improv teacher all over the place. Gary also has a new record out. We're going to hear more about that in a minute. Comedy Death Star is a production of Actors Comedy Studio and ACS Digital TV. ACSDigital.tv. I got to get that in. I'm Denzel Myers. Our guest today is Gary Austin. Hello, Gary.
Hello.
Tell us about this new record. Tell us about the record.
Well, I'm a songwriter, a singer. I've been doing songs, concerts, since the 80s, all over the country.
And you play the guitar.
I play the guitar. However, on this album, my album that just came out, Matt Cartsonis, that's mattcartsonis.com, C-A-R-T-S-O-N-I-S, who's a genius musician, was co-producer of this album along with my wife, Wendy McKenzie. And Matt plays all the instruments except for on two cuts. Somebody else plays keyboards. But Matt plays keyboards on all the other cuts. And, I mean, the guy's a genius. What can I say? Go to his website.
And you wrote the songs? You sing?
I wrote all the songs.
Yeah, that's great.
Oh, yeah, I sing. Yeah. My wife is a vocal coach who has coached some of the biggest stars and newest singers in the business, including everybody from Barbara Streisand to people who can't carry a tune. And a lot of people come to the house, and Melissa Manchester, for instance, who she's been coaching for about 15 or 20 years, and they get all the same exercises that the beginners do, which I found incredible.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Melissa Manchester can sing.
Yeah, she's a great singer. Well, yeah, no, I meant the great singers to the ones who can't carry a tune. Wendy traveled with her for years on the road, as well as traveling with the Moody Blues and a bunch of other groups as background singer.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. Before we go no further, I just want to let you know this is a tilt jar. If at any moment you don't want to answer a question or you think that what we really need is something different, the blue pieces of paper are locations and the pink pieces are pieces of dialogue. And if you kind of pull one or two of those, we can just go launch from there into something new.
Sure.
So if you ever think that is something you want to do, it's always there.
So just my option, just reach in and pull something out
anytime,
in the middle of anything.
Anytime you want. Yeah.
And then I'll know what to do when I see the piece of paper.
Presumably, we're improvisers.
Oh, we're going to improvise on what's on the piece of paper?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So,
okay.
You ever feel like you need that?
Sure.
Yeah, great.
Great. Thank you. Good idea.
So you have this album out, and what else you got going on now? You have a bunch of workshops that you do all over the country.
Yeah. Well, let me just say, first of all, the website for the album is GaryAustinMusic.com. Pretty simple. And my main website, which is for just about everything I do, is GaryAustinWorkshops.com. So that's plural, GaryAustinWorkshops.com. Everything I'm doing is on there.
Okay.
Including the history of the Groundlings, how I created the Groundlings with a bunch of people, but I was the guy. I was the Henry Ford of the Groundlings, let's put it that way. I had a bunch of workers. Brilliant ones.
It's so the opposite of a mechanized, closed production system.
Yes.
But
yes.
I understand the idea.
Yes, yes.
I actually wanted to ask a question about those days. I read on your website that you helped Paul Rubens develop his Pee-wee character. And I was just curious, what is that like to develop a creature?
Wow. I've helped to develop many, hundreds if not thousands, since 1972, including many of my own. One night in a Groundling class, and this is on my website, Phyllis Katz, one of the Groundlings and one of the teachers, I was also a student at my own company because I didn't want to stop acting. So one night, she says, let's do a takeoff on the Comedy Store. Everybody come up with a comedian type. And Paul was the only one who couldn't think of one. So Phyllis suggested something. I don't remember what it was, but what I suggested was, when I was MC at the Comedy Store, I used to put this kid up after 2, 18-year-old kid. He couldn't come into the room until, you know. And he looked like Sirhan. And his name was Jeff, and the first time I met him, he says, hi, Jeff, how do you want me to introduce you? And he says, Jeff. I says, Jeff what? He says, just Jeff. That became his name at the Comedy Store.
Just Jeff.
Just Jeff became his name. Yeah. So what he would do is, and this is what I told Paul, he would come up with a shopping bag, just a paper bag from the grocery store, full of props. And he would bring one prop out at a time and do a joke about it. None of the jokes were funny. None of them worked. The only one I remember is he would pull out a transistor radio and said, now I'm going to do my impression of a disc jockey. And he would turn the radio on. It was never a disc jockey. It was a baseball game, a song, the news, you know. anyway, just Jeff hung out for a long time and kept doing his thing. I told Paul about the character. So whatever Paul did, putting what I said and what Phyllis said and whatever was inside of him into one thing, suddenly, as if he had been touched by someone on high, the Pee-wee voice came out. And he was Pee-wee.
Instantly.
And then I helped develop that character in the Grounding show for a year. I put it up every show and worked on it as a solo character.
It's amazing to me when that stuff all somehow comes together. I mean, and you said instantly, the voice
yes.
can do it, or sometimes your posture can do it, but
yes.
it happens.
Yes, here's how it also came together. He says to me, what shall I wear? I said, well, I designed an old suit for myself when my girlfriend wanted to buy me a suit because I never had one. I designed it, and a Beverly Hills tailor made it. And everybody made fun of me, all my friends, when I wore it, because we were at the beginning of the 70s, and everybody else was in tie-dye. And I'm wearing this business suit. So I couldn't wear it anymore. It was humiliating. So I started wearing it for interviews, actors' interviews, when I went on nerd auditions to be a nerd. And I said, let me bring this and I'll loan it to you and see how it works. So he shows up the night of the performance with a white dress shirt, a red bow tie, patent leather, white shoes, and he hadn't seen the suit and I hadn't described it. It all worked, and all these years later, 40 whatever years it is, it's the suit. Nothing has been changed. And he
wants. Same suit?
Well, what he did.
Too small for him and all that stuff?
It's supposed to be too small. Well, he's taller than me.
So it's too small.
Yeah, he never changed anything. So what happened is he showed me once years ago the original, which had patches on the elbows and knees from use, and two copies, and they were exactly the same. Everything exactly the same, buttons, lapels, the size, the shape of the leg. If you notice, the leg goes down into a narrow thing.
Yeah, like
that was my design. How hip was I? And and so that's the suit.
Wait.
But that's how things come together, isn't it?
I just have to pause. So in the middle of the 70s, when everyone was wearing bell bottoms.
Early 70s.
You thought it was hip to have a tapered
bottom. Oh, yeah.
Bottom.
What did I know? It was my first suit.
You're really out.
But there. I had been hip before. I mean, when I was at the committee in San Francisco, Howard Hessman was my dresser, so to speak. He was in the company. And he would help me learn how to dress really hip, you know, and he would take me shopping and, you know. So, my God, I never had a suit. Ooh. So I drew one.
Yeah.
I went to the tailor and told him everything I wanted. And that's the Pee Wee Herman suit, the most famous suit in the world. Think about it.
Yeah.
And I got a C+ in wardrobe at San Francisco State in my costuming class.
Well, that's something different. I mean, I don't know if there's an answer for this, but I'm very curious, and I have theories about where things come from like that.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
There was a couple of not even ideas there with that,
that's
that
right.
creature. That,
that's right.
You know, and then somehow it all came into our field, and everybody knew that it was right instantly. And, yeah, I'm curious, where does that stuff come from?
I never. Yes, I never intended to create a company. I never intended to be a director or a teacher. I was an actor. Gary Marshall and Fred Roos had a company called Compass Management, and they were going to make me a star. Harrison Ford was in there, unknown. We were clients together. Cindy Williams, who had made one movie. Penny Marshall. Martin Sheen. We were all in this stable together, and we were all unknowns, except for Cindy. So what happened is I went to the unemployment window. I had come down from San Francisco where I was doing the committee, and I thought I had three more months on my unemployment. And I used to stand in line with Penny Marshall for $75 a week. Penny Marshall standing in line for $75. Think about it. So the lady says, "You're done." There's a technicality. She told me what it was. "You don't get any more money." I was sleeping on someone's couch. I didn't have enough gas to get back there. I didn't have enough money for lunch. And I had no money in my pocket. I panicked. I called up Howard Storm from the committee. I knew he was one of only two improv teachers in L.A. at the time. And he had a class, Robin Williams and Candy Clark were some of his students, and Lynn Stewart. And I said, "Can you help me get a space where you teach?" And he did. So this was a Thursday. On Monday was my first class. Fred Roos, who was head casting director at MGM at the time, knew my work from San Francisco as an actor. And I told him I was going to do a workshop. I said, "Can you suggest some people come to it?" He says, "I'll give you 75 names." And I counted them. It was 75 names. Harrison Ford, Linda Ronstadt, Jeannie Berlin, Elaine May's daughter. He said, "Call every one of these 75 people. And here's what I want you to say." And you have to say this to them.
Yeah.
"Fred Roos says for you to study with me or else." I said that to Harrison Ford. I said that to everybody. I got 21 students the first class. I stood up in the front. I says, "I've never taught in my life. I don't know if I can teach tonight. It's free. If you come back next week, it's $25 a month. We meet every Monday night." 19 of the 21 came back, and I had a class. And that eventually evolved into the Groundlings. And I never intended to create a company until I began to see how great the work was. I thought, wouldn't this be great to be putting it up in front of people?
And so in those early days you were starting to do that, what we thought about improv, I mean, first of all, nobody thought about improv the way we do today. I mean,
that's right.
It was not a popular thing.
Right,
you're right. And now it's also really locked onto this, it's about comedy.
You're right.
Which is a pet peeve of mine.
I'm so glad you said that.
But in that, yeah.
No, because I agree with you 100%.
It's a waste of technology to say that it's about comedy.
Absolutely.
There's so much more. In that moment when you were talking about having this class, what did people think improv was, or what? How was it positioned?
Well, I was teaching what I understood, and I did the classics as an actor at San Francisco State. One of my classmates I acted with was Dan Sullivan, the Tony-winning director on Broadway now. It was an incredible department, and I had great training. I played leads in lots of plays, and so when I came to improvisation, I didn't know what it was. So then I got in the committee, then I knew what it was. Okay, so it was improvisational theater. Now it's improv. Alan Meyerson, who created the committee, which, as you know, is a spinoff from Second City, and Alan was one of the directors of Second City, defines improv as people on stage doing stand-up for each other. That's improv. That's not improvisational theater. That's improv.
What I hate the most.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too. I don't go to see those shows. I walk out if I find out that's what it is. But I do improvisational theater. The commit Second City did that. Severin Darden and all those people. The committee did that. Nichols and May did that and created an entire what we do.
Yeah.
And they were so how do I define improvisational theater as opposed to improv? This is how I define it. If it looks like theater, if it sounds like theater, if it feels like theater, it's theater. Whether it's improvised or whether we're doing memorized text, I make no difference. And every student who comes to me, I say, look, you think that you've come to an improv teacher. I'm an acting teacher. And everything that I teach you about improvisation is exactly applicable to working with text and vice versa. I make no distinctions.
I like that. I mean, I hadn't heard it put that way, but I would agree. And I also think that using it in your life off of the stage, there's an incredible amount of stuff that you can do.
Sure.
As an improviser.
Like talking your way out of a traffic ticket, which I've done several times.
That's one example.
You know what the key is? Agree with the cop.
Find a way to agree.
Because what we do, you know that.
Well, then you raise the other person's status.
Yes,
feel
and no matter what he says, you agree. Yeah, I'm drunk.
Right.
Sure. Yeah. Can I give you a test? Sure. Let's do it.
Right, because they get angry, especially cops, when you argue and you lower their status and raise your own status. Yeah, a cop is gonna pull you out of the car and tase you.
Yes.
If you're lucky.
I'm sorry, I never said I was drunk to a cop. I only said I've been drinking. That would have been a mistake to say I'm drunk.
Thanks for clarifying that. I'm sure that our audience...
Don't tell a cop you're drunk, please.
I'm happy to know that there's a line there.
Yes.
Yes, I've been drinking. My story was that 16, 17 years ago, late 90s, I've been working in ad agencies my whole career as a focus group researcher, right? I interview people.
Right.
And then I start to work with the team to get the story started.
Right.
So that was been my job. And I had some friends that said, hey, there are these guys coming from Portland who use improv in a business kind of setting. And we're going to have a day to play some games and check it out, and you should come.
Right.
And I said, oh, wow, but never thought of that. And I walked in there, and the facilitator is starting to introduce the first game, which is a gift-giving game, right? You and I are back-to-back. I turn around and say, Gary, I got you this gift.
I understand.
And you open it up, and you discover at that point what is in
it. And I'm glad you used the word discover.
That's the key. In hearing the explanation, I was so terrified. My entire body triggered, and I would have run from that room, except that it was too embarrassing because all of my friends were laughing. And, you know, we did the exercise.
You mean they were laughing before you went up or after?
No, just because it was a fun...
I understand.
It's going to be great. Let's all do this. And I was terrified in a way that I had never been terrified before. And at the end of that day, or even maybe in that moment, all I knew was that whatever freaked me out about this, I needed to have more of that immediately. And so I just ran right at it. And, you know, the next 5 years in San Francisco, I did all the stuff I could to learn about it. I kept working in my field. I did a training as a life coach. And it was 5 years into it that I meekly said, maybe I should try something in the theater, which led me to here. But when I got involved, I was not a theatrical person. I had no training, no interest in that at all. I was interested in how it could help people work better together.
Sure, I understand.
And, I mean, it's great for generating ideas. Mm-hmm. But to me, there's also this thing about what you do as an improviser on stage to find ways to agree with other people, say yes, you're making something collaboratively.
That's right.
Everything we do in life is collaborative in this small group kind of way. And it's, to me, it's never a thing that we study or look at or understand. Like, how do I successfully make things with a small group of people? But everything we do, sports teams, musical ensembles, family, the accounting department, it's all a small group of people.
Right.
Trying to work together to make something together.
Yes.
And to me, that's what this is. Incredible technology for social creative action. Yeah.
I agree with every word you said. I have coached a lot of people who are really well known. Helen Hunt, when she got her Oscar, thanked me in front of a billion people as she was holding her Oscar. And that's very gratifying, of course. I couldn't sleep for 2 days, so I was so excited that my name was mentioned at the Oscars. Well, this is what thrills me more. I'll give you a mock email. By mock, I mean it's a model of many I've received. Okay. Hello, Gary. It's been so long. I studied with you in New York in 1987 when you were doing the such-and-such workshop. And I want you to know that you changed my life. Your workshop changed my life. She says, because of you, I'm happily married. I'm an attorney. I have 3 beautiful children. And I thank you for that. That is more gratifying than Helen Hunt saying, Gary Austin was my teacher.
And what was it about that person as an example? What was the impact of this work? How did that help her so much?
Well, I've had people tell me I don't go to my therapist anymore now that I'm in your class. I never, ever have intended, and I still don't, to make it therapy or anything like that. I just do the work. I do theater. And when I do theater with people, it's what you said before. It's healing, and it solves problems. It changes human beings. The bottom line for me was people say, what do you teach? Do you teach improv comedy? No. Oh, but you created the Groundlings. I never taught comedy there either. But you had a comedy show that turned into blah, blah, blah. I said, we did stuff and people laughed.
Yeah.
I never used the word comedy or funny. I forgot where I was headed with that, but it was something cool.
we're talking about how it changes people's lives and they don't go to therapy anymore.
Yes. It's going to come back to me.
Yeah, don't worry.
In my old age, you know, I'm 92, let's face it. In my old age, I have no short-term memory, but I can remember everything that happened to me at 4.
Yeah, I heard that's going to happen. I don't know where my keys are.
Yes, that's right.
I don't know who stole my cookie.
That's right.
I had another esoteric question, but I don't know if I want to ask that, actually. What about darkness, right? I said this show is about digging into the dark sides of comedy. For you, what's the connection between darkness, death, disappointment, and laughter?
My doctor said to me the other day, I have many maladies, and I should have died about 5 times in the last 6 years, literally. I was in the hospital a lot. And I said, why am I still alive? Because you laugh. This is from a medical doctor in Beverly Hills.
He can get disbarred for saying that, probably. Yeah, go
ahead. I won't say his name.
Good, thank you.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
It's a connect question about darkness.
Darkness,
yeah.
Okay. I learned, when I was an actor before I found improvisation, I came to Hollywood and had my first interview with an agent. And she said to me, are you comedy or serious? And I said, I don't know what you mean. Well, are you funny or are you serious? I said, I'm an actor. Well, yeah, but you got to be comedy or serious. Then she looks at my book, and I had about 24 8x10s. I didn't know you only needed one. She goes through the book, and she's frowning at the book. She's looking up at me. She turns the pages. She says, you know what? You are very handsome in person. I'm sorry. No, that's not what she said. Vice versa. She says, you are very handsome in these pictures, but you're not handsome at all in person.
No, that's funny.
I said, these pictures show how I photograph. I want to be in television and film. She says, but it matters more what you look like in the office. Oh, I didn't know that. Interesting. She pulls out an 8x10 of one of her clients who looks like Spanky from The Little Rascals. With a beanie on his head and a propeller and a goofy look on his face. She says, this is the kind of 8x10, this is the kind of picture you should have for your 8x10.
So she thought you were comedy.
She thought I was comedy. This never came up in college or any of my training.
No,
we never said that.
I understand.
I know you do.
Well, the guy who was here before,
yes.
Joel Bryant.
Yes.
Part of our conversation was that he's a stand-up comic.
Okay.
He's a very funny guy. He's an improviser with his wife. They work together. But when he is on television or in film, he always plays rapists, murderers, criminals. So, but he cannot get an audition for a comedic role on television or film, even though he does that work more frequently than he does the other work.
Well, here in L.A. as opposed to New York and Chicago, people are pigeonholed much more. So if you it's hard for people to understand that I'm an actor because I'm the creator of the Groundlings. So I do solo shows all over the country. I'm an actor. I just starred in a film that's out there, and I started another film that's going to be out there this spring. So I'm an actor again, whatever that means. And it's hard. Well, you know, I mean, some people, huh? What? You're acting? But you teach. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I don't get how that's so difficult for our brain. But when you're doing you wrote a one-man show?
Mm-hmm. More than one, yeah.
Yeah. So,
and I help people develop solo shows. So, and some of them have great success.
But with your material, what kinds of stories appeal to you? What kind of stories do you want to tell? Do you see any commonalities in the stories that you...
Yeah, I want to tell the truth. This reminds me of what I forgot a minute ago. When people say, "What do you teach?" I say, "I teach people to teach themselves to tell the truth." I don't teach them to tell the truth. I teach them to teach themselves to tell the truth. Okay. In all my solo shows,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's terrifying for a lot of people for a lot of different.
Oh, reasons. Of course.
Yeah, I mean it is.
And they walk away. Some of them.
That's what
they can't handle it.
No, I know. That's what's therapeutic. But yeah,
it is.
Our world doesn't support us telling the truth to ourselves or to others.
That's right. Well, look at the campaign right now on the Republican side. Don't look at it.
That's my only shred of hope is that none of those guys actually believe the crap that they're saying.
Good point.
If I actually believed that they believed it all, I would be more panicked.
It might be true of Cruz, though. I think he might believe it. Yeah. We don't know. I mean, we get our point. We get our mutual point.
He's the only one. So I was asking about your show.
Yeah.
Your material. What kind of stories do you?
Okay. I'll talk about two of my shows that I did for me. Both autobiographical. One is called Church and one is called Oil. I was raised in the Nazarene Church in Texas and Southern California in Whittier, where Nixon was from. And I was born in Oklahoma. So I come from Okies, and I was raised in the Nazarene Church, which is evangelical. When I was about 11 or 12, I nearly died from terror, literally physically. I began to shrink. I believed I was going to hell, and there was no way that I could ever be redeemed. Even God himself couldn't fix it because I had committed the unforgivable sin, blasphemy of the Holy Ghost. Knowing I was going to hell, my body began to shrink. And when I was 12 years old, I weighed 55 pounds.
Wow.
So I do that. I play my parents. I play all the characters. I play my parents. I play me. I play the preachers. And all kinds of characters. And it's a play. And if you looked at it on paper, you wouldn't know it was a solo show. It looks like a play and with many actors. And then I did another one called, so there was a lot of real heavy stuff in there. And lots of humor as well. Not because I tried to make it, but because it was funny. And then Oil, I grew up in Halliburton oil camps. My father had worked for Halliburton. And I was around rednecks my whole life. And so... this is about Cheney was in it. I mean, everybody was in it, dating back to me growing up in the Halliburton oil camps. And there was a lot of, ooh, man, that was a rough life, Gary, as opposed to, not as opposed to, along with things that happened to be funny and other things, not just funny, and not just serious, but other things too. I work with... I'll talk about one show. Libby Scala is the granddaughter of Lilia Scala. Lilia Scala was nominated for an Oscar along with Sidney Poitier for, how can I forget this? I've seen it so many times. It was the first time a black person had won Best Actor, and he got the Oscar, Sidney Poitier. And
guess who's coming to dinner?
No. It was about nuns in the Arizona desert. He built them a chapel.
I don't know anything.
And the Mother Superior was Lilia Scala. Well, when I found out that my student Libby Scala was her granddaughter, and that Lilia's had really trained her to be an actress, I said, "We got to do a show." She had never written a thing in her life. She says, "I'm an actor." Every time I would say, "You got to write a show," "I'm an actor." I said it three times in a row in front of the whole class. End of subject. I take her to lunch. "You have to write this show." I convinced her. She wrote the show. It's called Lilia. It's an international hit, standing room only. New York Times rave review by Ben Barkley or whatever his name is.
Brantley.
Sorry, Brent. Whatever your name is. Sorry. And then she wrote two more solo shows about her grandmother's sisters. One excited too. And those are all hits all over the country. She tours. She's done it here at the Groundlings. I brought her here to do it. So in this show, there are some heartbreaking moments and funny, hilarious things and all kinds of stuff. Like her grandmother thought Libby's nose was too big when she was growing up. And she said, in her Austrian accent. She was from Austria, and she escaped Hitler, and she would tell Libby, put your hands, your fingers on the end of your nose and push down, and walk around all day like that, so your nose will get smaller.
Because
your nose is too big.
Yeah.
And that was, for a little kid, devastating.
Well, yeah, I can understand.
So there's nothing funny about it, except the scene itself gets laughs.
So
sure.
It shows that the material you're interested in is real. It's real.
The truth. Stuff. What really happens?
Some of it shitty, and
sure.
All of it you lived.
Sure.
You live through.
Sure.
I think that's what we laugh at a lot, you know?
Yeah.
People fall down. If you get up and keep going, we love it. We cheer for you. And, that's what.
I was in Diary of Anne Frank. We got lots of laughs and lots of tears. I found out from Tom Tyrrell, the teacher who taught me the most at San Francisco State, that Chekhov's plays were comedies, according to Chekhov. He proved it. It was a comedy. The Cherry Orchard's a comedy. Who knew by reading it? But when we played it, truthfully, much of it was funny.
Yeah, well, anyway, I was going to get off on something there. Somebody's working on a scene in a class that was from a Chekhov play recently, and it was a monologue.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly this happened. Like, you get to the end of the monologue, and the last line, we said, well, this is the joke. But it doesn't seem like a joke. But if you look at the thing, through the monologue, the character kind of pulls herself from a despair, up, and the last line, she disparages herself. She drops in status.
Yes.
And that's the part that's funny.
Yes.
Right? If it was a heroic monologue, it would just go straight up.
That's right.
But the fact that it dips at the end is her letting go for a moment.
Yes.
And that's the comedy in that, you know, time and place in that situation. That's what people were going to laugh at.
That's exactly right. And do you know that Tennessee Williams also said his plays were comedies?
Like the Glass Menagerie and...
That's hard to tell, but certainly Streetcar is hilarious to me.
There are moments.
Well, Brando was hilarious, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. It's good to laugh. When I was a kid, I learned a lot of stuff from the Three Stooges, Mad Magazine, and Bugs Bunny. Because they were parodying things that I didn't know yet.
Yeah.
But I could tell that it was... making fun of something.
Right.
So then when I got much older and I actually went to the sources.
Right.
Like Mad Magazine's version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was hilarious.
Yes.
When I watched the movie, I was laughing all through it at all the wrong places. I just kept remembering all those jokes.
Yeah, that's right. Let me say one thing that I think will shed light on what you're getting at here with the darkness and everything. Richard Pryor, as we all know, had a very tragic life from the day he was born. He's my favorite comedian, but I don't think of him as a comedian. I think of him as a brilliant actor, and when he did his so-called stand-up, it's not stand-up to me. That's theater. That's theater. Lenny Bruce, theater.
Yeah. Louis C.K. I mean, I watched that guy.
Yeah.
Things he says they're not funny, but we're because we understand where he's coming from.
Absolutely.
It's his experience.
Candid Camera proved that, at the beginning, Alan Funt, when he had it, he proved that when they were playing tricks on people on camera, they would get angry or very negative in some way. But then when it got played back in the studio and they were sitting in the audience, they were laughing at themselves. It wasn't funny while they were doing it, but when we look at it, it's funny.
Because we survived.
Yes.
Didn't kill us.
Yes.
May I ask a question about the Herald?
I was with Del Close when he developed the Herald. We all developed it together at the committee here in Los Angeles in 1968-69. And he continued to work on it when he went back up to San Francisco. He was one of the committee directors, as well as being one of the people who created Second City. And I found... This is what I found out about the Herald. I used to love to do the Herald. I used to love to teach it, direct it, be in it. And then a couple of decades go by, and I can't make it succeed. I teach it, I direct it, it bombs, it's terrible. And what I learned from that is that the work that we do as artists comes out of an era. It comes out of a context. And the end of the 60s, Vietnam and everything, tie-dye, and early 70s were the only time the Herald could have ever been created. And so now, decades later, it doesn't work. I'm doing it the way they did it. I mean, that we did it then.
Yeah.
It's been, everybody has their own Herald. I mean, people do things that aren't.
Well, I see things all the time that people say, this is a Herald.
Yeah. It's not a Herald. So I quit doing it. I got frustrated. But what I'm doing now is I'm creating all kinds of new forms, especially with large groups of people, where I have 12 to 15 people on stage at one time. Sometimes more. I'm creating new forms which come out of my understanding of what Herald is when it's really Herald.
Yes. What I love about it, personally, is
yes.
You have these teams.
Yes.
They come out and they generate some material.
Yes.
And then they sit down and the other team comes out.
That's right.
And it is an exercise in reincorporation,
mm-hmm.
allowing things to permeate you and then letting them come back out. So to me, what I love about it is this intake and then spitting it back out. You never know what's going to get mixed up.
See,
and the places that can go when it really works is amazing.
That's the way I like it. That's the way I see it. That's the way I want it. But I couldn't get it to happen. So, and even in recent years, I couldn't get it to happen.
And so when you couldn't get it to happen, you meant that the ultimately the story at the end of the Herald form wasn't interesting?
Well, we never got that complex where we had a story at the end, but...
Well, you know, at the end
I had lunch with Del Close in Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
We were doing a festival, improv festival there. I said, and he was now with IO in Chicago. Improv Olympic. He and Sharna.
Yeah.
And I said, Del, the Herald has become incredibly complex. And what we created was so simple. Mm-hmm. He says, yeah, I hate the complex one. I says, but Del, you're doing it. He says, here's why we're doing it at I.O. Most of the people who come into I.O. are not actors. They've never been on stage in their lives doing anything. And they have no, and they are terrified. Many of them. So what happens is when we have the people standing in the back and then they can come in and go back to the back again, you know, they won't come in. So we created a structure that forces them in.
Right.
And that's why it's complex now. He says, I hate it.
Yeah.
So what I'm doing now is I'm creating forms that are really derivatives of forms that have been created before that, to me, do what Herald used to do for me. Example, I'm working on a form right now where we're doing an improvisational scene and the actors talk to the audience, asides to the audience, in character, more than they talk to each other.
Is this the 58th Street exercise?
No, that's the 48th Street exercise.
48th Street. I was going to ask about, is this what you're talking
about?
No. Okay, because I want to know what that is.
Oh, I want to tell you about that.
Yeah, okay, but finish this.
Okay, a character, let's say I do a classroom form. I do many forms of premises. There's a classroom, and you got a bunch of students and a teacher, and one of the students wants to say something, about what he, the character, is thinking, or she. So she comes out, and she tells the audience, you know, this teacher... I don't think she really has a degree. There's some stuff she doesn't know, for instance. Here's how I disagree with her on blah, blah, or whatever you say. Not that it's about disagreement. But, and then, so we know about that character, what she's thinking when she goes back to her seat in the class. The teacher also talks to us. And they tell secrets about each other. And they tell secrets about themselves. And they tell lies. Or they tell us the truth, and they tell the other characters lies. It's incredible, and I'm developing that the last few months in Seattle, New York, and here, And it's very exciting, a very exciting thing. In New York, they've created a new show at People's Improvisational Theater called, at the Pit, called Gary Austin's Classroom. That's the name of the show. And people call in and say, can I join the class? And they have to write back and say, this is a show called Gary Austin's Classroom, and they're doing my form.
Right. But I can see how that would work. You know, immediately when I tell the audience a different truth than I tell the character and vice versa,
yes,
all the layers of subtext start to get constructed,
yeah, and
by the audience.
Yes, yes.
In the audience.
Yeah, thank you. The audience writes the play.
They write the
play. We don't write the play, even when we're doing text.
Yeah.
Williams didn't write the play. The audience wrote the play that Williams put through the actors out to them.
Sometimes I think the writer's job is to say as little as possible.
I agree.
Say only what you must say, because everything else happens out there. And
that's right.
Immensely rich.
That's and right.
We only have, you know, 100 pages of...
Yeah, Jeffrey Sweet, writer, author, playwright in New York, who I work with, says that... oh my God! There it goes, my brain again. We were talking about. Tell me what we were talking about.
Saying as little as possible.
Oh,
yes.
He says, get rid of adjectives. When you write plays, get rid of adjectives. Get them out of there.
I think they're useful in development because they add color.
Yeah, it does.
I want the
there are exceptions, but
I'm going to cut them out.
Plays. Well, here's an example.
Yeah.
Let's say I have a character who says, "When I saw Sally, as beautiful as she was, sadly." She reported the crime. Cut sadly, which is an adverb, and in other words, Sally reported the crime, or something. This isn't a good example. I wish I had it in front of me. I could read it. But okay. So cut adjectives. Novelists have to use adjectives. Playwrights don't.
Yes, totally.
Because the audience writes the adjectives. That's called subtext. Like you said.
I don't know if I ever thought before that the audiences are the ones that write the subtext, but that...
Oh, that's how I teach subtext. I say, you actors, you can't play subtext. I can't play subtext. I don't know how to do that. But what I can do is I can allow the audience... I can find ways to help the audience imagine the subtext that they think I have. The great actress who did so much O'Neill on Broadway was Jason Robards. Her name was Colleen Dewhurst.
Okay.
An interviewer said to Colleen Dewhurst, "You're the most emotional actress in America, and you do a Broadway show 8 times a week, and you reek of emotion for 2-3 hours at a time. How do you do that?" And I'm going to do an impression of her that isn't really an impression because I don't really know how she would talk, but this is my caricature. Oh, darling, if I feel anything in a given evening for 15 minutes, I consider that a successful evening. But what do we see? Dripping emotion for 3 hours. Because we imagine it.
Well, she's a professional. She knows how to communicate.
Well, yeah. Yeah,
but we're doing all the work.
Yeah, and Robert De Niro has a one-minute video, which I have from some interview, that I send out to my students, where he says, what I've learned more and more as I go through this life of being an actor is less is more. He didn't say those words. That's a cliche. But he says, do less. Do less. Don't do anything. He says, sometimes just don't do anything. Let the audience imagine what you're thinking. Don't do anything.
Now, that's super interesting because I dance a form that is called contact improvisation. I'm not sure if you were familiar.
I haven't heard of it, no.
It's you've seen Argentine Tango.
No, I have.
Anyway, it's two people dancing together in physical contact.
Uh-huh.
They share a center, and there's really no form. So they may be rolling on top of each other,
lifting
each other up. You know.
Okay.
So it's.
I understand by what you say. I, yeah.
Frequently, I say to people, do less, right? If you're working hard, that's not it. We're supposed to be, we're following physical impulses, following how our bodies are together, and even to begin by pausing. The first time somebody suggested to me that I could begin a dance with a pause, some new stuff opened up.
Because of course.
I wasn't required
of course.
To do. I could connect and follow.
Let me tell you what I would require you to do as your teacher when you do an improvisational scene. Breathe, see, hear, follow your impulses. Period.
That's the job. That's the task.
Everything that you do comes under one of those headings, or all of them. What is follow your impulse? You do something, I react to it, because I have an impulse to a response. That's an impulse. Unless I think about it.
I'm with you. And at the same time,
yes.
I know that a skill in the world of improv, and maybe we don't like that, is speed. Something happens, and I need to respond fast.
Sure.
And
people feel that need.
Yeah.
Well, they don't have to.
Okay.
They don't have to have that. So I fight against that all the time in my teaching.
So if somebody walks in and says, "Sorry, I'm late. The traffic was awful," I may just not know what to do.
Let's say it's a board meeting. That person walks in and says that, and everybody looks at their notes. Nobody looks up. Maybe one person looks up. Somebody's writing something down. Somebody's going on their iPhone. And this person's being completely ignored as this person takes his seat at the table.
I'm already making up a story.
It's so much better than, "Why were you late?" or "I the traffic," or all that.
Yeah. That's what wants to happen. Nothing. No one responds.
That's right.
We're going to wait until somebody wants to make the next move.
Yeah, I think one of the things that improv, as opposed to improvisation, has done to people is that if you're not talking fast and saying something witty or funny and getting a laugh, you're not improvising. I do tons of things where dialogue isn't allowed. Monologues where dialogue isn't allowed. I used to teach at Deaf West Theater here in L.A.
I was going to ask So that's not happening at this moment.
Well, no, not with me, no.
Yeah, but it's
yeah. They're on Broadway now doing something.
Hearing and deaf people, actors together.
Together. Now, how do you improvise hearing and deaf people together?
Yep.
Okay. I put two translators, I forget what they're called.
Signers. Called.
Thank you. Two signers in the scene, and they have to play characters. They're not off to the side.
Right.
So let's say I have a hearing person and a deaf person in a scene together, and I have the two ASL people on stage, and I say, "Okay, Joe," I say to one of the ASL people, who are, of course, hearing, I say, "You interpret for Joe whether he speaks or signs." You do the opposite, or both at the same time. And by the way, the audience is filled with both deaf and hearing.
Yeah.
And then I say to the other actor the same thing. I say, "But also, you're playing a character. So when you sign and speak at the same time and no one else is speaking or signing, we know it's you talking." It takes about 3 minutes for them to find that rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
It's very slow at first just to find it.
Sure.
And then once you find it, it's slower than real life, but it seems like normal speed because stage time is always different time than real time.
And I would imagine in that context, then all this new stuff starts to happen.
Oh my God!
I've told
deaf people, you have to do a scene where you can't use ASL and you have to use your voice. Half of them cry when I say to do that, because they've been told they sound retarded from the time they were two. Don't make a noise. But then they do it. Here's an example, real fast.
No, we're good. I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Where we are. We're
okay, yeah. Great. So I say to I do musical improv with deaf people. Song improvisations with deaf people. Okay, now, leading into that, play a hearing comedian, can't use ASL, here's your mic, I give him a mic, I say, now do stand-up comedy. Now I want you to do, I don't even demonstrate. First of all, they can't hear me.
Right.
So it's all through us. So set up, punchline. Set up, punchline. That's your rhythm for telling a joke.
Okay.
And I apologize, and this is not meant to insult or make fun of, but this is what it might sound like. How do they know this? They've never heard a thing in their life, but they've watched comedians, and they know the music without even hearing it.
So
how is that possible?
When they get to that last line, the punchline, which, you know, is in gibberish, do people laugh?
Oh, we're hysterics.
Because
it doesn't even need a joke.
Totally,
it's already a joke.
Emotionally, they're fully
committed. Oh, yeah.
They know exactly what's happening.
Yeah. I call that the sound of comedy, by the way. We go to see a bad comedian. A guy takes his girlfriend, does a cover, dinner, the whole thing, $200. He better laugh.
Yeah.
And she better laugh, or he didn't get his money's worth. So they laugh at stuff that isn't funny.
Yeah.
I know that happens all the time. I was in the Comedy Store six nights a week for a year and a half when it first opened. I saw that.
Yeah. Well, people then, they want to be there. But when you go to an open mic, it's the opposite. All the other people there are other comics.
Of course.
They're all checking you out. Or they're looking at their own material.
Of course.
And if you say something clever or funny that makes them angry. And so, it's just funny to me that you go up to an open mic and you tell all these jokes and it's literally crickets. And it's so awful. It's funny.
An assignment I give actors who I teach. Go to an open mic. Don't think about what you're going to say at all. Don't plan anything. If you get ideas, throw them out.
You mean right before?
Oh, before you go up.
Yeah.
Now go up there and don't do anything that even occurred to you. Just start talking. Find out what happens in 3 minutes.
I see the wisdom of that. I already feel nervous about that.
But see, it bombs. But it first of all, it doesn't always. It usually bombs. But that's the point.
Yeah.
To get past the fear.
Yeah.
I bombed. They hate me here.
Yeah.
They might say never come back. I don't care.
I need to do that.
Can I use 4-letter words?
Here?
On this podcast?
Sure.
The Del Close taught me two things, and one of the two is this. He called it the fuck it adjustment, which means that when you go on stage, you say fuck it. And you say fuck it inside the whole time you're out there. And then when you come off, you can say anything you want to yourself. Or think anything you want. And I used to act with him at the committee. And I would see him do that backstage. He would be all uptight. And then just for his entrance, he'd go, oh, fuck it. And he'd go out, working with all these great improvisers, and he's one of the greatest. And then he comes off and he goes, oh my God, how was it? Was I okay? Was it... The fuck it adjustment.
So that's number one. And what's the other thing you learned from Dill?
I know there's a second one.
I know.
The other. To tell the truth. That's where I learned about telling the truth. Because, you know, he was notorious for throwing bentwood chairs at people. And everybody I've ever talked to who studied with him extensively either got a chair thrown at them or saw him throw chairs. I saw him throw chairs at people. He would throw them right at their heads. From the stage, he'd throw it at somebody in the audience who was giving him a hard time, somebody in the class. And he didn't care if they went to the hospital. They never did. Because you know why? Because they told the truth in the way they defended themselves. They put their hands up and kept it from hitting them in the face. And then we applauded. I saw this happen. We applauded because the person who was bullshitting him and bullshitting themselves mainly suddenly told the truth by catching the chair.
The best work you did all day.
Yes. And we would have, and Goodell would say, bravo! You told the truth. That's what I learned from him.
That's a Zen exercise.
Yeah.
Exactly that.
Yeah. But he would risk that.
Asks the question and the master hits him with a stick.
Oh. Oh, I don't know this.
No, there's a Zen story like that.
Oh, how cool.
And that's it. The student says, master, why does the sun rise in the east? And the answer is that he gets whacked with a stick. End of story.
That's Dale.
Yeah, there you go. He's a Zen master. Whether he knew it or not.
Wow.
I have some weird questions for
you. Go ahead.
You have a somewhat quirky bedtime or sleeping ritual? What is it?
I decide whether I want to watch MSNBC while sleeping or CNN, and I put one of them on, and I lie down on my pillow a certain way. I have to get adjusted just right, and I have to adjust the blanket exactly just right. And then at some point, I wake up and turn the television off and go back to sleep. Almost always. That's my ritual.
That's the way it goes. And the TV may not be on beforehand, but when it comes time to...
It's usually on beforehand.
Okay.
Which is one thing I'm trying to fix right now. We have the TV on too much. And so I'm starting to play music more on the stereo.
Yeah. All right, I support that.
Yeah.
Next question. As a child, you had an imaginary friend. That imaginary friend also had an imaginary friend. Where are they now?
Well, the imaginary friend was Jesus. And his friend was God, his father.
And where are they now? Have we heard from them recently?
Oh, in contemplating the universe, I have friends who are astronomers and whether I have friends or not. In contemplating the universe, it's hard for me to imagine that out of one grain of sand, this earth, one grain of sand, as it has many grains of sand as there are on this planet, that there are that many galaxies. Forget stars. Why is this one picked out? Okay. I'm using logic. Okay, logically it doesn't matter. Okay, it could happen. I can't buy it. There's an energy that happened, that happens, that we don't understand. I don't get it. I've went to two funerals this week of close friends. I just came from one today. Where are they now? Some people say they're with us. Some people say they're doing something else, that they're conscious. We've heard all the theories and everything. And I always, right now where I am is this. I was born in 1941. In 1938, I was having a great time because I didn't know anything. No pain, total peace. So I guess if I go back to 1938, I'll be okay.
That was the magic
year. It was fine. 1939 was great. 40 was great. In fact, the year 200 was great.
Right. 1941.
No pain. Yeah, that's right. That's right. 1941, it started getting difficult.
My family's all Catholic, and I really needed to answer these questions for myself. And I searched for most of 30 years, I would say, from when I was like 13 or 14 till my mid-40s.
Yes.
And I finally just let it go. I mean,
terrific.
I decided that whatever the answer is, it is not something that I need to know. It's not going to change my life to know if we came from someplace,
yes,
if we're going someplace,
yes, yes,
if there's a reason, if there's not a reason.
Yes.
It's immaterial for my life. That I'm paying attention to some other.
I think that's where I am. Iris DeMent, the singer-songwriter, has a song called "Let the Mystery Be," and it's about what happens after she was born a born again Christian. She probably still is, and she says, "I've given up on trying to figure it out." Basically, in the song, she says it very poetically, of course, and the hook to the song is "Let the mystery be." I'm okay with that.
Let the mystery be.
I'll never know. That's okay.
I like this. There's a philosopher, Ludwig Wittgenstein, and he is famous, among other things, for ending philosophy once and for all. Twice. The first time, he wrote a book aiming to end philosophy once and for all, like before World War I, and he didn't quite make it. But the second time, people agree that he succeeded. I mean, now, of course, we continue to have philosophers, and it's still a subject in the world, but you know, when whatever he wrote in his foxhole in a code in World War I,
because
he was Austrian, you know, ended philosophy once and for all. But it's still here. So that's kind of the spirit in which, if you just let you dissolve questions, Like, I have a little poster of his at home, and it is Charlie Brown and Linus in the rain, you know, with their baseball
stuff. Yes, right.
And somebody put this line from Wittgenstein. It says, "The rain falls on the just and the unjust."
Yeah.
And his point was, you know, that's not a philosophical topic. What is justice? What is, you know, lack of justice?
Yes.
And those are human issues.
Yes,
but
I see.
But if we take them out of that rarefied air and just bring them down to earth, we can. There's mystery, and we're just going to let that be that. And there are some things we have to deal with, but let's just not get those things confused.
Right.
Like, don't spend the energy trying to figure out what is justice. Does God really exist? Where did we come from? Why are we here? All those questions have just frustrated me and had taken up a lot of time and a lot of my bookshelf space. Anyway, that stuff does. Let the mystery be.
I'm there. What are you talking about? I'm there personally, and I'm also there in my work more and more.
What does it mean to be there in your work?
Being willing to completely and totally fail. And one of the things I tell my students is, when you do a scene that doesn't work, an improvised scene that doesn't work, if you do the work that we aspire to, the scene succeeded. If you put it in front of an audience, it would bomb.
And just to know, the work is what you mentioned a few minutes ago.
Breathe, see, hear, and follow your impulses. Now, obviously, there are thousands, hundreds of details that come under all those headings. But yes, that.
To be there truthfully.
To be there truthfully. And I don't care. And I remember when I learned this lesson at the committee, watching the best improvisers in America every night. I was stage manager before I was an actor in the committee. So I saw everything happen, 13 shows a week here in L.A. for 2.5 years. Actually, for 1 year that I was stage manager. And what I learned is that that when they did the late show on Saturday, and then when we did it when I was an actor, it always bombed. We had 8, 10, and 12. 12 always bombed. It was on a Saturday night. Same show, same scenes, same performances, same brilliant actors, but the last one always bombed. And but the work was just as good. And then when we did the improvisational set at the committee, I would say if you did 10 scenes, if you did 3 that succeeded, that was a high batting average, just like in baseball, .333. So, but what about the 7 scenes that didn't work? The audience loved that. Why did they love it? They saw integrity. They saw good work. They saw people working at the top of their intelligence. They saw people following their impulses. They saw people making discoveries. And even though the scene didn't work, they were entertained. And the audience is not sophisticated in the way that they studied theater and they know what we're doing. But that was amazing to me, that a scene that bombed could actually entertain. Peter Boyle came in one night. Second City was the sister city to the company to the committee. He came in one night and did a show with us in San Francisco, and every scene he was in just was horrible, just horrible. He was crying backstage. He was already a star, and it bothered him that much that 350 people saw him bomb, and he was already a hero to millions. He didn't care. He wanted to do great work. But guess what? The audience loved it. Hey, it's Peter Boyle.
So then, the audience loved it. Why do you say it bombed? What's the gap between the audience loved that scene and it bombed?
Well, why do they say that writing is rewriting? You get it right. You have to get it right. Bombed. Okay.
I get it.
We would repeat improvisations so they come set pieces. I would put them in shows if they worked. If they didn't work, we'd toss them. What does it work? Terrible scene. But when you're creating it, working at the top of your work, it's always satisfying to the audience.
Uh, keep talking about other kinds of things. I've adapted this, the Herald specifically, as a writer's program.
Okay.
For a while. And I worked with a group of writers. I started it because I had seven people that wanted to get together once a week and write together so they can support each other in
mm-hmm.
their writing.
Sure.
And they had some guy doing like some writing prompts. And they said, you know, can you help us? We think you can do better than that. So what I just started to do with them was basically a Herald. There are two different free association games in the beginning. They write some words down individually.
Yes.
And then they go back and look at the list and they circle any of them that are interesting. But then there's no requirement that those words be used. And we go on.
Oh.
And so we alternate then the exercises that I give them.
Right.
Is a kind of chase. Johnstone had a thing called verbal chase, right? When people thought that they weren't creative, he would ask them questions, or they would ask him questions, and he would say yes or no, and that would lead them along, and he had no content.
So
there are questions. I might say, it's cold out time. It's cold outside. What time is it?
4.
You hear something behind you, and you turn around. What's there?
A monster.
Okay. Now you can go from there. So I would give the writers
that's
that
cool.
kind of prompt.
Very cool.
And then they would each write for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And at the end of the 10 minutes, they had the choice whether to read what they just wrote to the class or not. But if you read to the class, then you give people the chance to reincorporate your material into their next round. So we would have a chase thing like that and then some kind of a game, right? Pulling lines from a bucket or
right.
any kinds. And so it would be like a chase, a game, a chase, a game. With these free associations in the beginning, some people would read along the way, some people wouldn't.
Yeah.
But the point is, like you're saying, while they're writing, that their experience of that activity is the only thing that I care about. The output doesn't matter. I want to know that when they're in
process versus result.
Yeah, that they can see the place, that
yeah.
they can smell it. And my coaching is like a Spolin coaching, right? Slow down, we have plenty of time. Don't, you know, we have no place to be. We're all with you. You know, if you get stuck, stay there. Go
well, we're very similar.
Yeah.
It's about process, not result.
So that has been really interesting. And so I worked a lot with the Herald and getting
yeah.
people to kind of do this group writer Herald thing.
Yeah.
And when anybody would reincorporate any element from somebody else's story, the satisfaction that the group from that
wow.
simple
cool.
connection
yeah.
would just, like, it would all catch on fire and then everybody would know. So this ability to hear, reprocess, spit it back out, have it come back in a different way. There are callbacks. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I've done an exercise where we watch an improvised scene and then I say, okay, sit down and bring two other actors up. I say, do the scene you just saw.
Yes. Yeah. And do they love that? Is that
yeah.
thrilling, right?
Yeah. And of course, there are many differences.
Of course.
Even though their job is to do it as much the same as they can.
But we want those.
It's never going to be the same.
No, but we want those. That's what that's
of course.
What's thrilling about it.
Of course.
It's going to come out and it's going to be different or
yes.
discover new information.
That's right.
Somebody has a secret, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's good. Oh,
the 48th Street. You want to talk about it?
Yes, we're good. Yeah, tell me what that is, and then I have one last question.
Okay.
What's the 48th
Street? An actor is on stage, one actor, and that actor changes her physicality and finds out what happens. That's the exercise. You keep changing your physicality and find out what happens. So suddenly, we're sitting at a table right now. If suddenly I stood up and turned my back to you and walked towards the window, I have changed my physicality. I don't know what's going to happen when I get to the window. In fact, when I stand up, I don't know I'm going to go to the window. And then when I choose to go to the window, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how far I'm going to, if I'm going to even get to the window. And then and when I get to the window, I don't know what I'm going to do when I get there. So So I've changed my physicality. So I can be in the middle of something and I have a sad my face looks sad. I'm talking about something sad. And suddenly I can grin and start doing some kind of a dance. Happy dance. And then find out what happens.
And you'll figure out why.
Yes, you'll discover why. You'll discover. And there are no transitions or transformations in the 48th Street. Everything is a jump cut.
Right.
Everything's a jump cut.
See, now, as actors, people get taught that you have to know and experience it and feel it, and then it comes out in your body. But this is exactly the opposite.
It's the opposite. You work from the outside in.
Totally the
yeah,
opposite.
Yeah, so you should... I'm doing those a lot now. I'm doing them at the Groundling Theater, in fact. You should come and see one. It's the most exciting exercise I've ever created of my own exercises, and I've done thousands and thousands and thousands of them for decades, and I discovered it accidentally in New York. I'm on 48th Street in somebody's apartment. I have seven people coming over. They have a large living room for New York, and by New York standards, it's two blocks from the United Nations. I'm sitting at the end of the room looking at the space. What am I going to do with seven people in here? Suddenly, I saw in those old Marx Brothers and other movies of that era where you're looking down a long hallway in a hotel and characters are just going back and forth in one door and out the other, in one door and out the other, and it's always a different character. And I thought, well, what if we had? Because I had, the way the apartment was, I had prosceniums. I had a dining room and a hall on the sides of the space that was going to be the stage. So I thought, well, what if the actor just goes back and forth and disappears and comes back, disappears and comes back, and every time the actor comes back, he's a different character, physically. No words. But I never said do a character, and I never will say that in this exercise. What I say is change your physicality. As soon as I say do a character, they go to ideas.
Right.
I don't want ideas.
Right.
In fact, I tell them, did you see the sign on the over the door when you came into my class today? No. It said, no ideas allowed. Oh, and also no creativity. You just do the task, you know. And so they're going back and forth. This one actor's going back and forth, and that's cool. And then I say, oh, talk whenever you want. Just say something. And I found that every time the actor changed his physicality, a different voice came out. But the actor didn't choose a different voice. It just happened, because it does. Okay, if you're all bent over, you're going to have a different voice than if you're skipping.
Right.
You know, so...
But your job is to accept that as the actor.
Yeah, yeah.
To go with that.
Yeah, yeah, and you don't have to know what it is, except that you're doing it. And whatever it does to you emotionally and mentally, it does, and you have no control over that. So then I noticed that, then I said, stay on stage. In other words, you can't leave the stage anymore in this little apartment. And so I said, just keep doing that. Just keep changing your physicality. And I had the exercise. But then what I did is I changed it so that we can see them. When they never go off stage. I put... something on the floor, like a water bottle or something, or a card. And they have to make an arc around that as they walk back and forth. And while making the arc, they have to do a sudden physical jump cut change, not a transition. They can't go from slowly bent over to erect. It has to be, I'm bent over, whoosh, immediately erect. And they do this while they're talking, when I get them to talk. And so I try to get them to do a lot in mid-sentence. You're in mid-sentence, and your one physicality and voice coming, and then you change the physicality, you stay in the same sentence, and it's a completely different character and everything.
Yeah.
And
messes people up, doesn't it? It's hard.
It's supposed to.
Yeah, I understand.
So now I have a new thing I'm doing at the Groundlings, which is, I did it in October, the best show I've ever directed improvisationally. I call it Two Ring Circus. I have two people on stage in the same space doing simultaneous 48th Streets. In other words, they're both doing a solo show in the same space, and every once in a while, organically, it comes together for a few seconds.
Right.
Maybe even as much as 20, 30 seconds. And then they go on their separate way again. And I say, 90% of the time, you have to be working alone. 10% of the time, maybe how much you actually interact with each other.
Right.
And I will give you the DVD. You have to see this.
Sounds thrilling. I can imagine that people are at the edge of their seats.
I picked some of my best people, including Mark Dacascos, the actor who he's most famous for, I guess, the villain on Hawaii Five-0, and also Iron Chef. He's the Asian guy who does the flips and everything. Mark Dacascos. And at the Groundlings, there are bars at the top, on the top of the stage. He was doing trapeze work and everything up there. And the other actor was in this doing her thing. Incredible.
Wow.
Incredible.
Sounds cool.
I'm going to give you the DVD.
I want to see that. All right, here's my last question.
Yes.
If you had permission to hit anyone in history in the face with a pie, who would that be? And I'm just going to remind you, this is not a hostile act. This person loves you and cares about you and is going to give you permission. It's okay to hit them in the face with a pie. Who would you like to hit?
I don't know why, but Lincoln was the first face I saw in my mind. I don't know where that came from. So I got to say it because the first thing that occurred to me. Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham.
Oh, today's Lincoln's birthday.
Is it?
Maybe it was already in my head. Yes, it is. Maybe it was already in my head about Lincoln. That's where it came from.
Well, maybe, but...
I don't know.
Lincoln
is my favorite historical character going back, but more recently, Bobby Kennedy is my favorite historical character. But certainly Lincoln.
With heading Lincoln in the face with a pie.
I don't know if you can tell by looking at me, but I have the same bone structure as Lincoln, facially. Oh, I do.
Yeah, okay.
If for my makeup class at San Francisco State, I made myself up as Lincoln, and I was walking down the halls, and I put on a top coat and a hat. People were freaking out. I looked like Abraham Lincoln walking down the hall.
Yeah, but he was taller, right?
Well, yeah, but I mean, just facial structure.
Yeah.
And I was able to just copy photographs and make it look just like him.
This is a little bit of an aside, but the movie that came out about him a few years ago, Lincoln, the Spielberg thing, oh, that was great.
Uh-huh.
The opening scene of the film is him with his son.
Yes.
His young son.
Right.
And they're at the fire. And the scene ends...
They're at the what?
They're at the fire, sitting in the living room.
Yes, yes, yes. I saw it and I'm having trouble remembering, yeah.
And just that short scene ends with Lincoln taking his son off to put him to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing that he does is to... It's kind of a close-up. You see him putting his feet in his slippers, these very mundane, average, normal person slippers. And then his kid kind of jumps on his back. He kind of lifts his kid on his back carries him off. And at that moment, I started to weep because the physicality of how you would pick up your own son made this historical figure that obviously you have known all about, blah, 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 it made him so real and so tender.
Yeah.
And that was the opening scene. And
yeah.
then I watched the whole film through the eyes of Lincoln as a father.
Yes.
First as a
father. How cool. That's your subtext.
And everything else after. And to me, that, I'll never know. I'll probably never meet Steven Spielberg or Daniel Day-Lewis to ask them about that. But there was obviously the text.
You've written your own film. You've written your own story.
Yeah. That's why.
Actors are a conduit. And directors are a conduit between the playwright and the audience, and when the audience receives it, they write the story that we didn't write. They write the story that we don't know anything about. Otherwise, there's no empathy with what goes on. How do you cry when somebody dies in a movie? Your hero dies in a movie, a character you love, when you know that guy's going to get an Oscar? Why would you cry? And you know he's a multimillionaire, and you know there's a film crew there, and Tom Hanks isn't alone on the island.
Right.
But suspended disbelief. What the fuck?
Yeah. Well,
otherwise, there'd be no theater or paintings or songs.
Or any of that.
Yes.
Good stuff.
Yes.
And there might not even be, like, jelly donuts, even.
No, none of those.
Probably.
Just donut holes, but invisible ones, because holes are invisible.
Somebody invented the donut hole. That just kills me. I would like to thank our guest, Gary Austin, improviser guru, for coming in this week. And thanks also to our producer and engineer, Dylan Vigil, and Dean Mermel, who wrote our theme music. If you would like to buy a Comedy Death Star coffee mug, you can send us an email at comedydeathstar@acsdigital.tv. You have been listening to Comedy Death Star, the official podcast of Actors Comedy Studio, right here in Hollywood, USA. I am your host, Denzel Myers. Thank you for listening.